Senator, please come back to order. First item of business are messages from the House.
January the 28th, 2015, from the House of Representatives, message number third reading passed. Mr. President, the bills listed below passed House on third reading by the vote indicated. House Joint Resolution number 4, Balanced Budget Amendment Resolution, ayes 44, no 16. House Bill number 75, Balanced Budget Compact, ayes 45, noes 15. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk. January the 28th, 2015, from the House of Representatives. Message, third reading passed, amended. Mr. President, the bills listed below pass the House on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. House Bill number 115, Vehicle Registration Timing, ayes 47, noes 13. House Bill number 124, Determination of Highway Right-of-Way on Federal Lands, ayes 60, Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
Next item is reports from standing committees.
January the 28th, 2015, Mr. President, Committee number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, to whom was referred Senate File 117, Air Quality Construction Permitting, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Anderson, 28, Cole, Cooper, Rothfuss, Von Flateren, Senator Von Flateren, Chairman. January the 28th, 2015, Mr. President, your committee number 4, Education, to whom was referred Senate File 110, State Education Accountability and Assessment 2, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Anderson, 02, Coe, Dockstader, Pappas, and Rothfuss, Senator Coe, Chairman. January the 28th, 2015. Mr. President, Committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, to whom was referred Senate File 129, Medicaid Share Plan, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Kraft, Landon, Peterson, and Scott. No, Senator Driscoll, Senator Scott, Chairman.
Senator Scott.
Mr. President, Senate File 129, Medicaid Share Plan, sponsored by Senator Von Flateren and others, that was just read in, has an appropriation in it. I ask it be re-referred to the Appropriations Committee as per Senate rules.
Without objection, Senate File 129 is re-referred to Appropriations Committee. Any further announcements? Mr. Vice President, we're at that order of business. Bills on general file. Consideration of bills on general file.
Why'd you go over there?
He needs a script. You say now. Let's see if he can do it.
Go ahead.
Practice.
Here's the... Mr. President, I move that the Senate resolve itself in Committee of the Whole. Back into Committee of the Whole.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion's been adopted. Senator Dockstader.
Good
job. It's amazing how the most simplest motions.
Put your game face on.
Committee of the Whole come to order. First bill for our consideration is Senate File 80. Reading. Clerk, read the bill.
Senate File 80, Trespassing to Collect Data Civil Cause of Action, sponsored by Senator Hicks. It was referred to Committee Number 5, Agricultural, State Public Lands and Water Resources. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Barnard, Christensen, Dockstader, Emmerichan, Geis. Senator Geis, Chairman.
You've heard of the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Geis, Chairman Geis.
Report. I move Senate File 80 do pass, and there's a standing committee amendment that needs to be read in.
Standing committee amendment, no, Senate File 80, standing committee amendment number 1, page 2, line 15.
I would also move that a standing committee amendment number 1 to Senate File 80. I yield the floor to Senator Hicks.
Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to dispose of the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 1, if we can, at first, so members of the body, I want to speak to that amendment. This amendment is conforming language to the bill that we sent out of here, which this is a companion bill to the criminal trespass side. This puts it in the civil trespass side. So what this does is go into and it conforms with the language that we've already sent out on the criminal side, which if you will go to page 2, line 15, inserts the word written or verbal permission, and on page 2, line 16, inserts the word written and verbal permission. Mr. Chairman, with that, I'd ask for favorable adoption of Standing Committee 1 to Senate File 80.
Question on the amendment? Question on the amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 80 is passed Committee of the Whole. Back on the bill.
Mr. Chairman, there was a Committee of the Whole amendment. Could I have that read in at this time?
Senate File 80, Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1, page 3, line 2.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 80. Members, if you will go to page 3, line 2. This really is, in some fashions, become redundant language. It's actually captured in the next line. This would strike the words cost of additional regulatory requirements. The next language in the bill says increased business expense resulting from an unlawful data collection. We're capturing the same thing twice, so this amendment just strikes that language. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd stand for any questions on this amendment. If there's no questions, I'd ask for favorable adoption of Standing Committee Amendment 1 to Senate File 80.
No further discussion. Question on the amendment. Standing Committee, Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 80. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Back on the bill. Senate File 80.
Mr. Chairman, back on the bill, as I've alluded to already, this is a companion bill. This body has already passed out a criminal trespass for the collection of data on the criminal side. This brings in the civil side. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to walk you through the bill. It does create a new section in our statutes, 4026-101, trespass and unlawfully collect data under the civil section of the law. If we go to page 2. This is almost verbatim language, as you saw on the criminal side, but it says under subsection A, a person commits a civil trespass to unlawfully collect resource data if enters into or crosses private open land, does not have statutory, contractual, or other legal authorization to enter or cross the land, or B, has written or with the amendment verbal permission to enter or cross the land to collect the resource data. Subsection B, a person who trespasses, this is the new language that brings it into the civil side, to unlawfully collect resource data of a person who unlawfully collects the data is liable for civil actions for all damages, including but not limited to. Turn your bill over to page 3. These are the things for which you could potentially collect damages for. Loss of income from delay in business operations, The last amendment struck that next provision. The second point would be increased business expense resulting from unlawful data collection. And then the next component of that is you could collect your litigation cost. That's the section where you'd be able to go into civil court and seek reimbursement for those expenses. New subsection C, a similar language you saw in the last bill, is just the definitions of open land. If you flip over to page 4, definition of a peace officer, definition of resource data, and then those exemptions for resource data on subsection A, for surveying to determine property boundaries and locations of survey monuments, is exempted, use by state and local government entities to assess property values is exempted, collected or intended to be collected by a peace officer while engaged in a lawful performance of his duty. Then we go to subsection D. This is the provision in subsection D that says resource data unlawfully collected under this section is not admissible in a civil administrative proceedings other than the civil trespass under this section. Members of the body, I emailed to you earlier, there was some question in committee that was brought up whether the legislature had the authority to restrict what potentially could be used in a court of law. Our LSO has done an exemplary job of answering that question. You have that on your email. I think the definitive answer that if you read that legal brief that they provided to us is absolutely the legislature has the authority to restrict what can be used in determining legal aspects of a case. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd stand for any questions on the bill.
Discussion on the bill? Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What about the value of your property if someone gets in there and gets information and collects it illegally, whether or not I'm that's part of your business, but it isn't specifically stated, and I'm just wondering if it extends to the actual value of your property.
Further discussion? Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, looking on page 3, as I understand it, the damages you can collect include increased business expenses resulting from the unlawful data collection. Am I correct in reading that then if your business is either restricted from doing something because of that or forced to clean something up and you get an additional expense, that can be collected then from the trespassing party under this law? Is that my first question, Mr. Chairman? Is that a correct reading of what's there?
Further discussion. Senator Coe.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have a question, too. We're going in here in 426.101, creating a brand new chapter. And my question is, what does this bill do that our existing trespass statutes don't already do?
Further discussion. Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Mr.
Vice President Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, along the same lines, I'm wondering, given the light of the last few questions, one thing I'm trying to wrestle with in my mind is for example, as far as whether the data collection would affect value, is ultimately, if there was the value would generally be like in the purchase of property between two parties, because they'd be talking about fair market value, presumably. In that instance, generally, a buyer would have the right to inspect that property, and with the right to inspect would probably follow either through the disclosure statement or the right to inspect that you would ultimately find out the data that somehow is devaluing the property. So I'm wrestling with that concept, and then, you know, as we look kind of this list of incidental damages that arise from the unlawful collection of data, it's kind of like I'm struggling with the concept that And I understand not being able to use it in a civil action or some kind of regulatory action. I'm not struggling with that concept. But, I mean, as you're going out and somebody's going to be paying these things, I'm having trouble understanding the concept of how you're damaged when ultimately it's if the data is viable or it's accurate data, how that damages that person. It may have been known or unknown, but typically that involves a third party and how that whole thing works. So, particularly with respect to value and buyers and things like that, I'm really struggling with how this would work.
Further discussion? Senator Escobel?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On page 3, line 5, this question I had was that, it reads, a successful claimant shall be awarded litigation costs. And I was just wondering if the reverse is true, if an unsuccessful claimant would be responsible for the defendant's litigation costs.
Further discussion on Senate File 80. Senator Kinski.
Mr. Chairman, rising for and on the bill, I think the senator from Natrona County raises a good point. And that's something that I would hope that we would be able to explore more fully on second reading. It is an intentional tort, and we'd welcome advice as to the appropriate measure of damages on an intentional tort. There may not be tangible damages, but nonetheless, it is a violation of somebody's property rights.
Chairman Ross? Sorry.
Thank you. Well, when we talk about litigation costs, litigation costs are pretty well known, and so they're pretty well set out. The cost of your transcripts or potentially witness fees, whatever else. However, normally not included in litigation costs is attorney's fees. So, in some respects, you'd want to weigh that policy decision is whether or not you want attorney's fees in there. It's good for me. It's good for lawyers. If you can collect your attorney's fees, and believe me, when you see some of those kinds of cases that are out there, mostly they're in federal kinds of statutes that allow the collection of attorney's fees. That's the hammer. That's where you get your money, is those attorney's fees. Here I am as an attorney, and I'm just pointing that out to you, that you want to be careful about that.
I'm just saying.
Chairman Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The good speaker just previous raises a valid issue. And are we making the problem worse or better? But I'd ask you to consider that some of these folks that are going to be fighting back against these kind of trespassers, they're operating on a pretty limited budget. It's dependent on the calf crop. It's dependent on how the harvest is going. And so they may not have the resources to take on a large special interest group that might be very well funded by some very wealthy benefactor. So it is a challenge. The good speaker, the good senator here from Cheyenne raises a good point, but you also have to think about the fairness of the fight. And some days, people don't have the means to enter into those kind of a fight. And so they're froze out of it just because of economic factors.
Senator Hicks, you got your notepad ready? Oh, wait a minute. Senator Kinski.
Mr. Chairman, with respect to the point raised about legal fees under federal statute by the senator from the Windy City, it's true, and there are some environmental activist, extreme activist groups that's how they fund themselves, is the fees they make off of those environmental lawsuits. I'd say good enough for those groups, good enough for Wyoming ranchers. What we would hope is that as this pattern of intentional trespass continues, that there would be groups on the side of the Wyoming ag interests that would push back and, yes, seek legal fees and costs, because we all know that's where the real money is, given, however, that the attorney's fees are reasonable as specified by law. Thank you.
All right, Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, I'll try to go through the questions and start with the good senator from Cheyenne here. In fact, much of that language you see here was a policy issue that was adopted last year. This provision comes in under the computer trespass. So when looking at that bill, what I tried to do that we passed out of here last year was to bring that in there. That particular legislation on computer trespass says you can recoup litigation fees. This does also say attorney fees, so there is a slight deviation there. Question to the other good senator from Cheyenne, my co-senator on the Judiciary Committee. What happens if you're unsuccessful? Well, then you just spend a whole lot of money on attorneys and collecting information. So that's the remedy there, is there's a disincentive. If you don't win, it's going to cost you a lot of money. I hope that answers that question. And then to I'm going to try to bring this in because I think the good senator from Natrona County and my good friend from Park County up there kind of asked the same question. This is, how are you damaged, and then what's the purpose of this bill and what's it do? Let me see if I can at least capture what's it do. Under the criminal trespass for data collection that we passed out here, you penalize the perpetrator of that action. There's a criminal penalty for they doing that. But how does that make the injured party whole? It doesn't. You've penalized them, but you've come back and said, well, if they've incurred, you've incurred significant financial damage as a result of their actions, how do you make that individual or that business entity whole? Well, you go to civil court and you seek those costs that damage caused you. So that's the question as far as, you know, what's the bill do? It provides a remedy for making those people whole that were damaged based on a criminal activity. Let's see. I believe it was the other good senator, the tall one from Natrona County, is talking about damages and unlawful increased expenses. And I don't know if that answered the question. I may have to have that question asked again. I can't remember it. The value of the property, the actual physical property, I guess that wasn't contemplated. Certainly that's something that we can come back with an answer to. And the second reading amendment, Mr. Chairman, with that, members of the body, I would ask for your favorable consideration of a yes vote on Senate File 80.
Any further discussion? Chairman Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I'm still unclear as to what the increased business expenses covers. Does it cover an expense that a regulatory agency might stick an individual with that as a result of the data that got collected? That's the question.
Senator Hicks?
Mr. Chairman, ultimately, I think that decision would reside with the courts, but that wasn't necessarily the intent. Let me give you a couple examples of where this may come into play, because they're real-world examples that I've had some experience with. I have in my district two of the largest landowners in the state of Wyoming, and I can give you a couple real-world examples where this has occurred, where they incurred significant increased business expense. So we had somebody that, at that time, trespassed, went out and collect data that they weren't aware of. So they surveyed a road and a pipeline to go to a oil location. But because they're in the checkerboard, they got to go from the federal domain to the private domain. So while they've incurred the expense to survey, design, the engineering fees, the archaeological clearances for this, on the federal domain, an individual went onto their property and found what we would call fire pits that could have been done by a sheep herder in 1900 or a cowboy in 1880 or who knows. Without carbon 14 analysis, you can't date them, but basically under the Cultural Historic Preservation Act says you at least got to look at them to see if they're, well, guess what? that information now resides in the federal domain with the Bureau of Land Management. They said, we're not going to approve your road, and we're not going to approve your pipeline corridor until you go out there and on your private property you conduct a very rigorous archaeological survey. In the meantime, they run into what the Bureau does is calls winter stipulations. So while they're waiting to get an archaeologist out there and they collect the information and find out that it's not culturally, historically significant, they have to give that information to the Bureau of Land Management. That sits on somebody's desk. Pretty soon they run into a situation where they now have winter range stipulations, and we're a year later before they actually can go out there and build a road on their own private property. That's a real-life example of where this has occurred. I can give you other examples with ferruginous hawks, that people illegally collected data that caused significant delays in being able to develop our mineral resources on private property. So the intent, Mr. Chairman, when we talk about increased business expense, is exactly that. When somebody illegally collects data and then interjects that into a database, and keep in mind, under the criminal aspects, we can't require expungement of that data out of a federal database. So it resides there in perpetuity. So what's the remedy? Well, the only remedy now is to basically, because that data was collected illegally, is to come back through the civil system and at least try to recoup the damages due to that lost business enterprise. Mr. Chairman, I hope that answers the question. I would ask for favorable consideration of a yes vote on Senate File 80.
Senator Case, Chairman Case.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm trying to get my hand around this or my head around this. But, Mr. Chairman, the part that's bothering me is that, you know, we've got some crazy laws out there, most of them federal laws, that have implications for landowners. There's no question about it. Things like Endangered Species Act has enormous implications. Perhaps state laws about archaeological preservation, all these things have implications. I agree. But those laws were put in with a public purpose, perhaps wrongly, and perhaps I disagree with some of them. But now you have a trespasser that has uncovered things relevant to those laws, things like, well, there's an endangered species on there, a triple-toed snail darter upside-down cake fish. And that fish exists. And it has implications under this other law. It has implications for the landowner. It has implications, and it could be discovered in other ways down the road. You know, this bill beating the heck out of the person that discovered that fish or exposed that fish doesn't change that law was put in for a perhaps dubious public purpose at the federal level. But it's still the law. And the landowner is still impacted by that law. It has now come to light because of this person trespassing, but you can't undo all that because the law is there for a public purpose. And so I don't really see this bill. I see a bill like we had before with civil penalties to discourage folks from doing this. But I'm sorry, I meant criminal penalties to discourage someone from doing this. But this is sort of the horse is out of the barn now. And there is a public purpose for what the data was found for. And I realize it's distasteful to myself and the landowners in Wyoming, but it was a dutifully passed law at the federal level. I don't see the relevance.
Let's go Senator Scott and then Senator Meyer in that order.
Mr. Chairman, I continue to be concerned about the language on page 3, line 3, and let me give you a hypothetical case. Suppose a landowner, the irrigator, goes out and discovers that a patch of his alfalfa, say about the size of this corner of the Senate, is dying out of something he just irrigated, and it looks and it smells sometimes like it might be a herbicide that does that, and alfalfa is pretty sensitive to those. And he says, where in the heck did that come from? And goes up the creek, doesn't bother to ask permission, just goes on up the creek and looks, and discovers that his neighbor is not properly disposing of his herbicide containers, just piling them up and they're leaking into the creek. And that's where it's coming from. And he complains to the authorities, and neighbor winds up getting required to clean up this, where he's been dumping these herbicides. And that's an expensive cleanup. No, cost $10,000. Okay. Is the guy that discovered it going to get stuck with that cleanup expense because he trespassed to get the data to tell the powers that be where the problem was? As I read this language, I think that's exactly what could happen. And that concerns me greatly about this law, that maybe we better take a careful look at some of the language here and see what we're getting into.
Senator Meyer, and then Senator Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And please, let's do take a careful look at this language. Let's move the bill along. There's a reason that this bill is out there, and basically it's because some people are violating the law, and that's the law of your private property. And that's basically, you think it's right for somebody to walk inside your house and go into your kitchen and look underneath your sink? I don't know what they're going to find there. Maybe they're going to find some unchildproof containers or something. And so maybe that's against the law or the civil statutes of your city. You're not supposed to have unchildproof containers underneath your sink. But property is property, and this is property rights. And what we're doing is saying that, no, you can't trespass and you can't injure people. And you look at the Constitution, the good tall senator from Natrona County knows this as well as I do, is that you don't pass any law that prohibits getting injury back if you're injured. We can't do that. That's against the Constitution to say that if you're injured, you can't get your money back out of somebody. You know, and so, you know, folks, it's private property rights. You know, it's to me, it's pretty well cut and dry. Now, we can look at some of the unintended consequences, and indeed we should look at the language very closely. But let's move this bill along.
All right. Senator Hicks, follow
up. Mr. Chairman, and I would hope that we could move this along. I think maybe we can work on some language in the second reading to get that cleaned up. Be more than happy to work with those that have concerns with that language. In regards to the good senator, my chairman of the Appropriations Committee, this bill doesn't alleviate or obfuscate the responsibility of a party if they go out and violate the Endangered Species Act. They do that at their own risk, or the National Historic Preservation Act. They still will fall under and be captured under that law. That is their liability. What's not their liability that when somebody else subjects them to that act, and in many cases, knowing full well that there is no legitimacy to that, that they do it knowing that it's going to slow the process down because now they have to go out there because somebody said or found a little bit of information that shows speculation that increased cost. So it doesn't alleviate anybody from those federal rules and regulations and laws. They're still under that burden. But, Mr. Chairman, I'd ask for a favorable consideration, and we can work on some stuff before second reading, and hopefully get some of these answers for the committee, for the body.
Thank you. Ready for the question? Question being called. All those in favor of Senator Geis's motion to win the committee of the whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 80, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. Senate File 80 has passed the committee of the whole. Next bill for our consideration is Senate File 77. Reading clerk, read the bill.
Senate File 77, Ignition Interlock License Amendments, sponsored by Senator Perkins. It was referred to Committee Number 1 Judiciary. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. I, Senator Christensen, Esquivel, Hicks, Kinski, Von Flader, and Senator Christensen, Chairman.
Heard the reading of the bill. Senator Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 77. There are no standing amendments, and I ask you to call on the Senator Perkins for the bill.
Vice President Perkins.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, what you have before you is what we believe is probably a cleanup or a tightening of some of the ignition interlock license issues that have come up over since we passed this bill several years ago that required ignition interlocks. Just a little background, Mr. Chairman, what we've got and what we know is as this program has been initiated and implemented by the Department of Transportation, there are roughly about 1,500 or so individuals in Wyoming that are driving with licenses under which they are required to have an ignition interlock, and they have those licenses. Mr. Chairman, the other thing we know is from the process that goes through in the administrative process of once you're convicted of driving under influence, and then it moves over to an administrative proceedings and a procedure inside the Department of Transportation with respect to your driver's license. So what we know is that there's about another 12 to 1,500 of those individuals who are required because of their offense and because of the law to have an ignition interlock, and they don't have those ignition interlocks. And so what they've done is what's happened is they found out that they can, when they get through it, their 90 days of suspension, all they have to do is wait, if it's the first offense, another 90 days, and they can simply avoid having to have the ignition interlock at all because the time has expired. And so what we've got is a couple of instances where individuals either are driving either, and then when they get caught, they're cited for driving without a license instead of a heavier penalty for driving without an ignition interlock, which is a heavier penalty. So what this bill does is comes back and says, okay, the original intent of the ignition interlock legislation was to change behavior. So when people got in cars they couldn't drive those cars unless they could pass the breathalyzer that's been installed into their car. And so this comes back and does two things. The first thing it does, if you go to the top of page 2, Mr. Chairman, is it provides that when you have a time required for an ignition interlock device, as specified in certain paragraphs, and I'll go through those in a minute, that time limit that's imposed there shall not include any time period for which the person required to operate only vehicles equipped with an ignition interlock device is not licensed to operate a motor vehicle or is under suspension or revocation. So what we're saying there is you can't simply slam this and not have the ignition interlock. This would prevent that. And just to go back and show you, for example, what it is, those subparagraphs it's referring to, subparagraph F, Romanet 2, is the first offense first time that you're convicted of driving under the influence, you have a blood alcohol limit of 0.15 or greater, you're required to have an ignition interlock in your vehicle for 6 months. In Romanet 3, under that paragraph, you would be a second offense. You're required to have an ignition interlock in the vehicle for 1 year. In paragraph number Romanet 4, it would be a third offense. You're required to have ignition interlock for 2 years. And for the fourth or subsequent offense under paragraph F, Romanet 5, you're required to have it for a lifetime, although there is an opportunity to have that removed if you can show a period of good behavior. And so that's what that does. It simply says that, when you have to have the ignition interlock, these are restrictions on a driver's license. You can't not have the restriction on your driver's license for the period required by the law. So that's what the new new subsection N would do. The second thing it does, which is at the bottom, is that when you have the ignition interlock and you've done that, there's a monthly report that comes back from the data logger that's reported back to the Department of Transportation. The data logger indicates that the number of times and the instances under which you have attempted to drive your car while intoxicated, and he reports that back. So one of the things that happens if you do that habitually under the existing statute, if you do it habitually, then you can have your license revoked without restriction of driving with the data logger. What's happening and what you see from the testimony was in committee, that we heard in committee this morning, was that some individuals use these simply as breathalyzers to see if they're sober enough to drive, and so it hasn't changed the behavior at all. An example was given with personal knowledge of the person testifying, that what happens, he got a call from this
from somebody who had one of these, and he said, you know, this thing works just fine when I'm driving north, but it doesn't work while I'm driving south. Something's wrong with it. Well, he knew the habits of this guy. What happened was, from his home to his favorite watering hole, he drove north, and from his favorite watering hole to his home, he drove south. So, yeah. Anyways, as you look at these things, at the end of the day, you know what we, the idea behind the ignition interlock was, at some point, we can stack penalty on penalty on penalty of individuals who drive under the influence. But at some point, we have to physically restrain these people from driving, because there's no manner of threatened imprisonment or no manner of fine that's going to stop them. I've come to the conclusion that people, Mr. Chairman, just don't make good decisions sitting on a bar stool. And so what the purpose of this is to say, you've got to change your behavior. And the purpose of the ignition interlock was to implement a physical requirement where it would change behavior and they would become more self-aware about how they do this and why it went, and to change the habit of drinking and driving and thinking that they're willing to roll the dice and not get caught. And we know that, tragically, that when they roll the dice and they drive, drink and drive, that it affects not only them, but we certainly have highways and fatalities and lives that are crushed on way too much of a regular basis because that behavior hasn't changed. So with that, that's the bill. I'd stand for questions and ask for the body's favorable consideration.
Further discussion on the bill? Further discussion? Question on the bill?
Question.
All those in favor of Senator Christensen's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 77, all those in favor say aye. Those opposed say no. Senate File 77 has passed the Committee of the Whole. Next bill for our consideration, Senate File 73.
Senate File 73, Forcible Entry and Detainer Amendments, sponsored by Senator Ross. It was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Christensen, Escobel, Hicks, Kinski, Von Flatern, Senator Christensen, Chairman.
Heard the reading of the bill, Senator Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your committee.
Oh, we've got the wrong script in front of us. Mr. Chairman, when Committee of the Whole rises to report, I recommend it does with a due pass recommendation on Senate File 73. To present that bill is Senator Ross.
Senator Ross.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the Senate, bring to you Senate File 73, Forcible Entry and Detainer Amendments. The genesis of this bill goes way back to the initiation of a bill that I sponsored several years ago concerning access to justice, which is a program to help our indigent people have access to the civil justice system. And as part of that that legislation was the creation of the Access to Justice Commission. I am a member of that commission. That commission is comprised of lawyers, judges, and lay people who spend and donate a lot of their time pro bono to this program. And as a result of our meetings, as we hold our meetings throughout the year, we hear from the, Wyoming Legal Aid, or for what we have created in Wyoming, Equal Justice Wyoming, that there are still some glitches in our system that prevents individuals from having full day in court or having due process. And one of them is in the areas of forcible entry and detainer. What is forcible entry and detainer? Basically, you're talking about generally, landlord-tenant cases in which perhaps the tenant has not paid their rent or for whatever reason. The normal statute or the statutes require that first thing that happens is a notice to quit. You file the notice to quit and it's posted on the residence, and it has to be 3 days before you can then file your forcible entry detainer action to get somebody out of the premises or whatever. or, and it doesn't have to be landlord-tenant. It can be somebody that's kind of squatting on your property also. But in any event, the current statute is on page 2 of the bill, and the current statute basically says that when the complaint for forcible entry and detainer is filed, that if the defendant does not file an answer, a written answer basically, that defendant may not offer any evidence at all on his part and shall only be allowed to cross-examine the plaintiff's witnesses. So basically what this bill does is to try to rectify that situation. These cases occur in circuit court, and generally what happens is they're not sophisticated. And in fact, many of the complaints are filed by without even a lawyer, and then the other party shows up and doesn't even know what an answer is, let alone that they had to file one, and then they're precluded at all from saying or telling the court why they don't feel they're in violation or not. I mean, there are certain obligations that we impose by statute on landlords, and it could be as simple as this. Landlord didn't fix my plumbing. I was without heat for a week, and I didn't think it was appropriate to pay my rent until he fixed it or whatever else, something to that. You know, I mean, you can hear all kinds of different things. All this bill does is basically say, look, you come into court. You can file an answer if you want, and if there is an answer filed or not, the complainant can amend their complaint if they want to. The answer can be filed, and it can be amended if they want to, but you're not precluding somebody from at least having an opportunity to have a say in the courtroom as to their position concerning that action. And that's what this bill does. It just gives them an opportunity to have their day in court.
Further discussion on the bill? Majority floor leader, be bound.
Mr. Chairman, the other part of Bill 26111, just a question on taking 5,000 down to 2,500. If we could.
That's the wrong bill.
Am I on the wrong bill? That's good. You're doing such a good job there, Mr. Chairman of the Appropriations Committee. I thought you were talking about numbers.
Further discussion on the bill? Further discussion on the bill? Question on the bill? Question on the bill. All those in favor of Senator Christensen's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 73, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. Senate File 73 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 75.
Senate File 75, Child Support Enforcement Amendment, sponsored by Senator Ross. It was referred to Committee Number 1 Judiciary. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Christensen, Esquivel, Hicks, Kinski, Von Feder, and Senator Christensen, Chairman.
Heard the reading of the bill. Senator Christensen.
Chairman, I move to when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 75, Child Support Enforcement Amendments. There are no standing committee amendments. To further discuss the bill, I would ask that you call on Senator Ross.
Senator Ross.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Now on to the bill that the good majority floor leader had a question on. I'll try to address that right up front. There are three components. There are three components to this bill. The first component is in bottom of page 1 and basically over to 2-7-205. 2-7-205 is related to probate. And basically what this section deals with is who gets notice if there's a probate, and the purpose of the language that you see on the bottom of page 2 is to provide that the Department of Family Services would get notice if the decedent, the person who died, or if that person has a heir at law, and if that heir is known, and they're either the decedent or that heir is an obligor, meaning they owe child support, that the Department of Family Services gets notice about that. And I've had a couple of these situations where somebody dies and they die without, or they die and they have, and they still owe child support. What do you do? Well, as a result of welfare reform in the 1990s, and of course, Senator Scott was around and duly appointed me as the enviable position of child support guru for the rest of my life. Part of the whole child support program is wrapped in to welfare reform. And we as a state are looked at by the feds in terms of how we do in collecting child support as to how we get our TANF dollars. Having said that, we are, I think, the number one state in the nation right now for collecting child support, which is truly a good thing. And quite frankly, this is about the kids. I mean, it's about, you know, an obligation that if the obligor doesn't pay his child support, somebody's going to pay that. And it's generally us, the state. And we have provided a mechanism for the collection of child support through the Child Support Enforcement Division. That mechanism allows, if there's means-tested income, the Department of Family Services can come in and collect and assist in the collection of child support without the assistance of having to have a private attorney. You can also, even if there isn't means-tested income and a parent isn't getting their child support, they can come in and file a $25 fee, and the state of Wyoming will assist you in collecting your child support. That being said, it's important that they get notice as a result. If there's somebody that's died or if there's an heir that's going to get money, that perhaps that child support should be paid. So that's the first component. The second component is that when you get over the top of page 3, which is in the Title 20, which is your domestic relations statutes, there are provisions, 20-2-102, which is not in the bill, which is where a party can come in and simply file a petition for support. And they haven't actually filed anything with regards to custody or visitation. It's just simply for support. And what some courts have interpreted the fact that there is a finding of child support, and child support is premised generally on who is the custodial parent, that somehow that is a de facto determination of custody when, in fact, it is not. All it did was award child support. So the language in the new subparagraph H is a finding of physical placement of a child in a child support order, just a child support order, is not considered a disposition of custody, so that you don't run into, as I mentioned in committee, the Latin term res judicata, that somehow it's already been determined custody. So that's an important provision. Now let's get to the third component. And all of these stand on their own. So if you don't like some of this, you can certainly take it out. But the last one is with regard to the suspension of driver's licenses. I think it was last year I brought a bill that based what was going on with regard to the obligors avoiding the suspension of their driver's licenses if they made any sort of payment, $5, towards their child support. That was good enough to keep them from getting their driver's license suspended. We changed that to say you have to make at least one full month's child support payment. And that's done a good job of helping and collect child support. The level was set at $5,000. Now, the average child support payment in the state of Wyoming is $285. So the purpose of this is to reduce that level down to $2,500 as a further incentive to get these people to pay their support. You can argue, is this a good policy or not? It is somewhat of a double-edged sword, because if the person doesn't have a driver's license, it's pretty difficult to work. And where is that threshold? I submit to you that $2,500 is a number of months in arrears in child support, and all you have to do is pay 1 month and you don't get your child support, or you don't get your driver's license suspended. The reality of it is that there are also, when you find out, if they find out about this, when they get this notice, and that's the other part of this, they get a notice that we're going to suspend your driver's license. Right now it's required by certified mail. We're saying first class mail. Now the reason is that I think that the reason we want first class mail is, one, it reduces costs. It'll reduce the cost of DFS about $2,500. But the reality is that more likely than not, people will get notice, and that's what you're supposed to get, notice of something. They're more likely to get it with first-class mail than going if they get a document, a little card, and it says certified mail, and they don't go pick it up. So that's the two pieces in that third component. The $2,500, that's a policy decision for us, but I submit to you that this is reasonable. They haven't been suspending driver's license. And generally when somebody gets a notice that they have, that they're going to suspend their license, they go, well, how am I going to get to work? And then they find out and they say, well, geez, if you're working, they don't want to have to do this. All our statutes provide for what's called a withholding order. And the withholding order takes directly out of their check. And they much rather do that than suspend any driver's licenses. So that's the best as I can tell you to answer the 25 versus 5. I think it's reasonable. I think it's important that these individuals pay their support, their obligations. If you want to dance, you've got to pay the fiddler. I mean, your actions have consequences. And, these children are out there, and if they're not getting their support, the state of Wyoming is picking it up in some sort of means-tested benefit.
Jordy, floor leader, Bebound.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Now on 26-111, and I really appreciate what my colleague from Laramie County said, and I agree with you a lot of the things you said, because clearly, you know, those people that have that obligation should do it. My question on the $2,500, and you're exactly right, it's a double-edged sword. Did you give any consideration in another way to try to entice them by saying, you know, give them maybe a couple of leeways, like 2 months before he suspend or something? Or the other thing is, why $2,500 instead of $3,000 or $3,500? And what you said is exactly correct. These people, and if you're garnishing their wages, and I see a lot of this for some of my employees, most of them are garnished. They're young and all of the things that we all know about. And then the garnishment gets in trouble, and then they have some other things going on. They're trying to work to drive long distances. It makes it difficult for them, and they're struggling anyway. Did you talk about any other way to try to mitigate the impact of, you know, if you're really falling behind, we're going to try to really get it, rather than trying to reduce this from 5 to 2,500?
Further discussion? Senator Ross.
Thank you. I guess best answer to that is no. We really didn't talk about it. And certainly this is an easy fix depending on where you want to go with it. But the current state of the law is 5,000. The question is, do you think that's the appropriate figure or not? I would submit that the first class versus certified is appropriate. That's the policy decision that you have to make here. But I would submit to you that I don't think that $2,500 is unreasonable, given, now, with the downturn in the economy and whatever else, you know, we got problems there. But, you know, I would tell you that as a general rule, having worked for a number of years now with child support enforcement, they haven't really taken that hard line with regard to suspending anybody's driver's license. They've tried to work with them. And if there is a withholding order, it may be that their income is such that it doesn't get to the full child support amount. Because it's you're limited by what the law says in terms of how much you can garnish from somebody's check. So with that said, that's the issue with regards to the 25 versus 5, but I think it's reasonable.
Further discussion. Senator Von Fladen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the points that was made in the committee was that the 2500 matched the passport revocation. So the federal law says that $2,500 they can revoke your passport. So that was one reason they picked 2500. The other was that they said they had 9,000 cases of people that were 2500 or greater behind in their payments. And so what they want to do is catch them a little bit earlier. They call them up or they send the letter. The person almost immediately calls them, says, I need my vehicle. You can't take my license. I have to get to work. And they go, oh, you have a job? Where do you work? So what the statute says is that you have to have made a monthly payment in the last 3 months and or not fall behind. So they will say to the person who I think the average was $285 a month was the average child payment that they have out there right now. And that is averaging five children, one child, everything. It comes out to $285. So what they will say is, well, you've got to make that month's payment. Once you make that month's payment, the past month or if you're 5 months behind, and get on some kind of payment program with them, either through garnishments of your wages, now that they know you have a job, or just by writing them a check and catching up, at least 1 month's full payment, because you've got 3 months' grace period after that moment, then they don't take the license. They said it's pretty rare. I think I had 179 licenses have been pulled since 2009. So in 5-6 years, they've been running this program. It's a pretty minimal amount that they ever get that next step. But they do get the person's attention. They figure they start them out earlier, catching their attention, and it matches that passport revocation. So the combination of two is where they came up with that $2,500.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, in the initial introduction, it was complained that a senator had been designated or recruited or whatever as the expert. Mr. Chairman, that was Committee 10. It was welfare reform. And I think the record shows that we in Committee 10 know how to recruit competent expertise in the service of our programs. And we very much appreciate it. And, Mr. Chairman, on a little more serious note, when that was started in the mid-1990s, Wyoming was nowhere close to the first in the nation in terms of getting these obligations paid, and we were down at 13% of all child support being collected. And this has been a very successful program, and I'm gratified to hear that we're now number one in the country on that. I think it speaks well for the state and for the legislature.
Further discussion on the bill? Question being called. All those in favor of Senator Christensen's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 75, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. Senate File 75 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for... Oh, Mr. President.
The privilege of the floor, please.
Proceed. Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, we have a guest with us who is Danny Taylor. She's Miss Rodeo in North Dakota. She's going to be back here for Cheyenne Days. if you would give her the courtesy of maybe talking to us up at the mic. And I guess the first thing I'd like to understand is why she has a friendship with Byron Otakovin and former Representative Tony Rose, of all people. Yeah, that's sort of the way I think. I mean, that's the first thing explained, but we'd like to learn a little bit more about you, Ms. Taylor, and welcome to the Senate.
Thank you. I guess to answer his question, Tony Rose is my dad's best friend from college, so I just recently spent 3 weeks at the Denver Stock Show doing various things from being involved in the rodeo, parades, banquets, the whole nine yards. So kind of recouping here in Cheyenne, and then I'll leave for Rapid City tomorrow for the Black Hills Stock Show for another week where I'll finally get to return home after being gone for a month. So being a rodeo queen is kind of time-consuming, but I am still finishing my very last semester. I'm majoring in broadcast journalism and political science, with hopes of kind of doing this sort of stuff. I'd like to be a PR person for the agricultural field. My parents sell Case IH tractors, so agriculture is very near and dear to my heart. Other than that, thank you guys for your hospitality. I really enjoy Wyoming and have loved to got to see some of the sites with Tony Rose, and I look forward to coming back and seeing you all during Cheyenne Frontier Days.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. President.
Mr. Chairman, I've known Tony Rose for a long time. That's the first time I knew that he actually went to college. That's pretty impressive. Or that he had friends.
All right, let's proceed now. Next bill for our consideration is Senate File 119. Reading clerk, read the bill.
Senate File 119, Hospice Respite Care, sponsored by Senator Scott. It was referred to Committee Number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. I, Senators Kraft, Driscoll, Landon, Peterson, and Scott, Senator Scott, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. Chairman Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I move in the committee the whole rise and report it do so with a recommendation that Senate File 119 do pass. There were no standing committee amendments, and I will explain the bill. Mr. Chairman, this bill comes to us courtesy of our local hospice up in Casper. They had the legislators in before the session, and they were complaining. They had a problem. What's happened is the world has changed. The hospitals are keeping patients longer. The hospices have them for less time. The result is that there's spare capacity in the local hospice. And I will say, Mr. Chairman, from personal experience, I know that hospice does a first-class job. Very good operation. And so instead of whining and complaining, the hospices say, okay, we've got these expertise. What can we do that will help the community that can bring in some more business, some more revenue? And what they hit on was the idea of providing short-term respite care for people with long-term illnesses and their home caregivers. Either they have to have some time off or they get sick themselves or any number of things where you need somebody else to take care of the individual for a short period of time, that knows how to take care of people that are sick. With the nursing homes in our community, which are pretty much at capacity, the government paperwork involved is such they're really not that interested in the very short-term business. And so there's a niche that's available. They contacted their licensing people in the health department, and the answer was no. And no. And CMS won't let us. And our hospice is very resourceful. Somehow they got an internal email from CMS saying, that's a state issue. Let the state take care of it. We don't care. And they came to us, and we said, well, let's write a bill. And we wrote, Mr. Chairman, a 3-page bill that was pretty fierce and had a few spikes in it and some teeth. And that got over to the health department and got to a little more senior level of management. And we got a call being very apologetic about the way they treated our hospice and saying, yeah, we'd be happy to accommodate, but we do need specific authorization. And they sent back one sentence, which you will see on page 2, starting at line 2 and through line 6. And I said, you pass that, we've got the license to do it, we'll do it. And everything will be fine. In the committee hearing this morning, Mr. Chairman, this proved to be of interest to a number of hospices around the state. This will be a help in some of the smaller communities where it will allow the hospice people to fill in where there's gaps. There's some others that may take advantage of this. It looks like it will result in a very sensible making available of some very valuable resources to the people of the state, as well as solving the problem with the business model. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Further discussion on the bill? Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Certainly no questions. I just rise in support of this bill. Recently, had the experience of having a relative who was considerable age, made his way into critical care in the hospital, spent some time, but we needed somehow to make a transition. And a lot of the transition facilities, and there are a lot of different definitions, were just simply not available. We learned in the process, sometimes hospice is synonymous to many people with death, and that's not the case, always. There's a considerable percentage of people who go into hospice and by good care and whatnot are able to leave and do just exactly what this bill would imply to do. I could go on in detail. This relative has since passed. He went into a transition, I think, that probably, without being too specific, was not as desirable as this would have provided. But I would just simply say that I think there's a great need here. I think this is me personally. This bill resonates with me personally more than any bill that we've acted upon. And as this sponsor is so well known for, demonstrates common sense, and I would hope that you would approve it.
Further discussion? Further discussion on the bill? Senator Escobel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just wondering, I'm certainly in favor of this bill, but I was just wondering in regard to providing that respite care. We recently talked about the Lifesaver program, and in that kind of situation, if the parents were incapable of taking care of the individual, I would assume that something like this would be of service to those type of individuals also. Would my thinking be correct on that subject? Thank you.
Senator Scott?
Mr. Chairman, if I understand the question, would this enable outfits like the hospice to take care of some of those individuals? The answer is yes, but the intention is to use it only for very short term and for somebody with a very serious or chronic illness, because that's where their expertise is. And you need to keep the terms relatively short so that they do have beds come free for people who need very traditional hospice care, which is their primary mission.
Any further discussion? Further discussion? Question on the bill? Question being called. All those in favor of Senator Scott's motion, the when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 119, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File 119 has passed the Committee of the Whole. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move the Committee of the Whole rise and report.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Mr. President.
The reading clerk will please read the Committee of the Whole report.
Mr. President, your Committee of the Whole, having had under consideration bills on general file, begs leave to report as follows. Senate File 36, do pass amended. Senate File 91, do pass. Senate File 56, do pass amended. Senate File 35, do pass amended. Senate Joint Resolution 1, failed to pass Committee of the Whole and was indefinitely postponed. Senate File 80, do pass amended. Senate File 77, do pass. Senate File 73, do pass. Senate File 75, do pass. And Senate File 119, do pass. Senator Dockstader, Chairman.
Chairman Dockstader.
Mr. President, I move for the adoption of the Committee of the Whole report.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The report has been adopted. Do you have any reports? No reports? No bills to read in? Nothing? That clears the desk? Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that clears the desk.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, I move that we stand adjourned until 10 a.m. tomorrow, Thursday, January 29th.
Are there any announcements? Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, your committee number 8, Transportation, will meet at 3:30. That's about 10 minutes up in S-14 to discuss Senate File 93, County Road Fund Pavement Management, Senate File 2, Bar and Grill Liquor Licenses.
Senator Ross.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your Appropriations Committee number 2 will meet tomorrow morning, 8 a.m. in S-11 to consider the appropriation with regard to Senate File 129, Medicaid Share Plan.
Senator Ehrmerk.
Thank you, Mr. President. To your committee number 5, Agriculture, State and Public Lands and Water Resources will meet tomorrow upon adjournment in room S-15 to consider Senate File 126, Water Quality.
Senator Cooper.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, your Travel Committee number 6 will meet tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. in S-14 to consider Senate File 105, Game and Fish Roundup Program, and Senate File 114, Game and Fish Resident Preference Points.
Senator Case, can we read this in? Has it been read in? Senator Case, since we had a motion to adjourn, can we cover do this tomorrow morning?
Mr. Chairman, I have that scheduled for hearing.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader, would you take? Can you withdraw your motion to adjourn, please?
I'm thinking about it. Mr. President, I withdraw my motion to adjourn.
Without objection, the motion to adjourn is withdrawn, and nobody's objected. That having been the case, Senator Case, do you have... Oh, this is a first reading. So we're back to introduction of Senate files. Senate File 140, first reading of the bill.
Senate File 140, Wyoming Telecommunication Act Rewrite, sponsored by Senator Case.
Senate File 140, having been read a first time, is assigned to Committee Number 7, Corporations. Now that completes the desk. Back to you, Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Mr. President, I move that we stand adjourned until tomorrow at 10 a.m. Thursday, January 29th.
And is there an announcement? Which I assume is what brought all this about in the first instance.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your Corporations Committee number 7 will meet tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. 8 a.m. Notice 8 a.m. You guys get to sleep an hour.
to take up Senate File 41, Employee Online Privacy. That is a reconsideration. Senate File 99, Wyoming Pharmacy Act Amendments, brought to me by a dear friend from who's the Majority Floor Leader. Senate File 43, Wyoming Telecommunications Act Revisions. Senate File 140, Wyoming Telecommunications Act Rewrite. Thank you, Mr. President.
Well, it's nice to see that corner make a mistake now and then, since they're the ones that seem to watch the protocol so closely. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, announcements.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, your Rules Committee number 12 will meet tomorrow, Thursday, January 29th, upon adjournment in room S11 to consider the following Senate file: Senate Resolution 4, Constitutional Convention; Senate File 116, Legislature Compensation; and Senate File 89, Supplemental Budget Bill Voting Requirements. Also, Mr. President, your Oversight Committee on the Capital Project will meet upon adjournment of both bodies today in room 302.
Are there any other announcements? If there are none, you've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion has been adopted. The Senate shall stand adjourned until 10 a.m. tomorrow, Thursday, January 29th.
See what he did? He fired the existing and put in a guy that he wanted. And then I don't know if his son was on the 44 or not, then he showed up.